Hello, everyone. Welcome to Ubi Est Mia. My name is Brandon Weatherby. This episode is with Harold Moore. Harold is a former Chicagoan, current resident of Washington, D.C. Harold works for Blue State Digital, so we talk a lot about politics in D.C. versus Chicago, working on campaign trails versus working in the nation's capital, growing up in Austin, and much more.
How was your day?
It's been good.
What'd you do?
I went to work. I had a performance review. We had a party for resellers of our software. I went home and read a little bit, and then I came here.
What'd you read?
There's some long-form stuff on Uber, and there's a really interesting article in the National Journal about what happens after Jesse Jackson dies or moves on or does whatever.
What's your actual job? Like, what's your title?
So I'm an account manager for technology at Blue State Digital.
And what does Blue State Digital do?
Blue State Digital is a very large marketing firm and software company. So we provide digital services and software to some of the largest campaigns and nonprofits in the world. So we were the firm that built MyBarackObama.com. We were Labor's digital provider, so we built all of their website and all their stuff. We work with groups like the United Way and Starbucks, and
is it fair to say that mostly liberal?
Yes, all liberal.
Considering the name of the company.
Yes. One of our bends is that we work with largely progressive companies and causes.
That's kind of why you're out here.
Yeah.
Well, you're from Chicago.
That's true.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Austin. So I grew up at about North and Cicero.
Okay. And how long were you there?
So I lived in Chicago my whole life up until I was about 26. I lived in Austin until I was about maybe 19, and then I started living wherever you live when you're in your early 20s, so bouncing into, you know, various flop houses across the city.
Well, you shouldn't say flop houses specific. There are flop houses. You do not technically live in a flop house.
No. Various DIY spaces, studio apartments, places where my meager salary at that time could support me.
How often do you think about moving back simply because you could afford to live in like a 4-bedroom apartment for what you're probably paying for a studio in D.C.?
Very, very often. I've been thinking about it a lot. I look at Redfin all the time and just dream about things. I was looking at Craigslist the other day, and for what I'm paying right now, I could get a 3-bedroom in Pilsen in the fun part of Pilsen that had, you know, hardwood floors and exposed brick and would be every sort of apartment dream.
Yeah, you have to go home to your D.C. apartment after this.
Yeah, I live in a basement underneath three young men who just graduated from Middlebury. And they play acoustic guitar at all hours of day and night. And it's something else.
All right, so from 0 to 18, 19, you were in Austin. And then from 20-ish to 26, you were throughout Chicago.
Yes.
And now you're in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
Why did you move out here?
So my background's in political campaigns and elections. So I was running political campaigns for congressional candidates, for city council candidates and others. I was running a particular race out in the suburbs of Chicago for a candidate for U.S. Congress. We had won our primary. I decided that I just did not want to work with her anymore. I said, you know, you've got 3 weeks to find somebody to replace me, but I'm out of here. I'm going to go just hang out for the summer. And one of my vendors from that race called me and said, hey, you've done a really good job. This person's been very difficult. Do you want to move to D.C. and write messaging for the AFL-CIO, for the large labor union? And I said, yeah, sure. And about 2 weeks later, I moved here.
When you say you're one of your vendors, like, what does that mean in the world of politics?
So political campaigns take up a lot of space. So they encompass fundraising and some marketing. So you've got to send mailers and you've got to put up websites and you've got to, you know, have people who knock doors and things like that. And this vendor in particular was the person who created and designed all of our mail.
Okay.
So this person flew out to take pictures of the candidate, to take pictures of the district, to create a narrative that we would then send to voters.
Okay. Yeah. So they knew somebody that was like currently in office in D.C.?
Yes, they knew someone who worked at the AFL-CIO who had been looking for someone to help them put together their member communication program for the 2012 election.
And so you've been here since like one election cycle ago. So a little over 3 years.
Yep, that's right. That's right.
Are you regretful?
No. So DC's been really good to me in a lot of ways. I think that the quality of my work has improved. I think that I have a ton more confidence in my abilities and just a bit less confidence in the abilities of others.
You have less confidence of the abilities of others since you left Chicago?
I think that I phrased that poorly, but I think that moving to DC demystified some of these big names that you see and some of these big accomplishments that happen, and you recognize that some things are obviously the result of very hard work, and some things are very much the result of just being in the right place at the right time or just having the right resources to do the things that you need to do.
Well, you said something like a lot of people echo, right place, right time. Yeah. Is this always the right place? It seems like it kind of is. If you're in the world of politics like you are, don't you kind of sort of have to be in Washington, D.C.? Or is it possible to do your job in Chicago and thrive?
It's certainly possible to do my job in Chicago and thrive. I think that the work is in the cities. The work is in the states. The further along that you get into national level politics and civics, the more you realize how much cool stuff is happening that you just can't touch from D.C.
Like?
The Black Lives Matter movement has nothing to do with Washington, D.C. They do get some funding from some of the big foundations here and some of the big groups here, but all of that stuff is happening completely on another track from everything that's happening in Washington, D.C. As well, if you look at, say, labor, the work that you would do working for the national AFL-CIO here is very different from the work that I had done working for, say, SEIU in Chicago, where I was organizing security guards to give money for political action. So it's a lot different to be asking, 20 security guards a day for a $5 contribution, and then to come to D.C. and have your office overlooking the White House and only be working with other D.C. people, if that makes any sense. There's a bit of a disconnect there.
Obviously, it sounds like there's a disconnect. It sounds like a two completely jobs with similar titles.
Yeah. So there's just a lot of space between them. To answer the big question, though, I think that change can happen anywhere. I think that there's really great work happening everywhere. I think, though, If you can swing a trip to DC and you work in this industry, you should probably take a little time and do it. You should probably, I think it's like going to LA if you're an actor. You should probably go spend a year out there and see, what's what. But, you don't absolutely have to be here in order to be successful at the work.
You said that a lot of this stuff has been sort of demystified for you.
Yeah.
Do you have any specific examples? Be it people, causes, organizations, et cetera.
So I always thought that the way that some people got to work inside of the White House was because they were the absolute most brilliant people that existed in the space at the time, or that they were such virile champions of their cause or of their niche and this work. And I'm learning that some of it is just a decidedly political process where if you knew the right guy who knew the right guy and you were available at the right time, you could certainly, you can get a boost into a White House appointment fairly easily. That's not to say that the game's rigged and that no one can win and that, I'm cynical, but not that cynical. But when I worked for the Obama campaign in 2008, and we had an office manager in St. Louis who was just awful, just terrible, terrible worker. Could not get us our paychecks on time, which is like the bare minimum of what she needed to do, which is why I'm not sad about like saying she was awful. But I worked for Obama. I found myself looking at Wonkette in 2009 and seeing her on the front page as about to exit the White House because she had been working in the White House since the president was elected. And I wondered to myself, how could that sort of thing possibly happen? And it turned out she was like the daughter of a donor.
So some stereotypes are true.
Yeah, some of those things are true.
Now, you seem to always know everyone in the room, or most people in the room, whenever we've gone to different rooms, be it this city or Chicago. Mm-hmm. How do you meet the right guy? Do you just, or is that just like an open-ended like BS question, where it's like, how do you be nice? Like, is that really all I'm asking? Because is that all it is? Or do you have to actually have any expertise? Or is it simply just like making eye contact, it being interested or at least feigning interest, and that's it?
I have a friend who he is a fundraiser, so his job is to go and shake down people for money for campaigns and causes, and he's really, really good at it. And he calls me infrequently, probably once every couple months, and asks me if I have someone for him for work. And sometimes I can throw a name to him and he'll hire that person, sometimes not. But I was talking to him one time and he said, look, most people in this town are going to be some level of about the same level of skill. Like, people are going to be very good students or very smart or very gifted. But what he wanted more than anything else was someone he could be a buddy with, which was a very strange thing to hear. Because it was really interesting to hear that he wasn't looking for someone who was going to revolutionize his work or someone who was going to give 115% or anything like that. He just wanted someone he could chuckle with while he did these, you know, sometimes grueling processes.
One of the things that you started to do once you came to this city is play rugby. Yeah. And you're currently on a rugby team. When you came here tonight, you're wearing a winter cap, and it's your rugby team's cap. Yeah. You didn't have that in Chicago. You didn't seem to need that in Chicago. You had a lot more friends there. I'm not saying you didn't have friends here, but yeah, considering new city, it's a new sport. Do you kind of have to be buddies with everybody if you're on a rugby team? Or just naturally, you become buddies with everybody in a rugby team. Who have you met from your rugby experience here that's like shaped DC for you?
The reason I joined the rugby team was because rugby for me was a release. Whereas in Chicago, I had DIY spaces. I had, you know, I had my family. I felt very comfortable being in my own skin in Chicago and not sort of having my identity so well tied to my work. I didn't quite have that here in DC. You know, everyone that I knew when I came was somewhat political or somewhat political related. Joining the rugby team gave me a family where if you just wanted to go and have a couple beers and just talk about nothing for a while, it was really good to do that. And you got to meet a bunch of people who we've got on our club. We're the largest club in the country. We have a few doctors. We've got, you know, people who are spokespeople for senators. We've got people who are data nerds. We've got all sorts of folk, but we don't talk about work. No one's asking to get hooked up. No one's asking for anything like that. It's just a mutual love of the sport and of the brotherhood of the sport. Off the top of my head, the person who most shaped DC for me was Jeff Wetzel. Jeff is he's a teacher who teaches robotics to inner city youth here in DC. Takes his students on tours to go and compete with robot building competitions. He's a former EMT. He's a biker. You know, he owns a home out in the far end of the city in Northeast on like Rhode Island and 30 something. And so, like, at the far end of the city, what he embodies for me is he sort of, like, just lives D.C. to the absolute fullest. He owns the city or claims a bit of ownership over it in a place where everyone else is sort of on their way out the door or on their way out to the suburbs or on their way, you know, anywhere but here. So he'd be the first person that I think of from my club who really embodied D.C. for me and, like, really made D.C. look like a place where people live.
Yeah, sure. That sounds awesome. But you, somewhat too, still won't claim ownership of this city. Why? Why can't either of us be like, we're proud DC residents, but we always seem to talk about Chicago and going back or visiting way too much to be healthy? Why are we doing this, in your opinion?
I think there's a bit of a feedback loop where people come here to stay for 3 years, and so because your friends leave every 3 years, you start your countdown clock anew every time one of your favorite people leaves. I think the city is also just changing incredibly rapidly. And so it's very difficult to have a really good sense of what old DC looked like. Whereas I know what old Chicago looked like. I know what old Austin or what the old West Side looked like. I know that gentrification is creeping towards my neighborhood now, but I still feel very connected to what's going on in Chicago. Whereas, anytime I get into a car in DC, if I drive anywhere out of, say, Northwest, they say, you know, 10 years ago, this place was a big smoking hole in the ground. And that's an awful feeling, not only because, you know, we represent the rapid changes of a community and the displacement of many, many people. As well, there's just... It's very difficult to feel like this place is a home for anyone. It's not very intergenerational, so I don't see a lot of children. I don't see a lot of very old people. You know, the city's not set up for people to get very far outside of, say, Northwest or North, let's say, H Street at this point. So you don't have many opportunities to go out to the Southeast or to Southwest or other places. And so it's not a place that's built for people to really like live and take ownership over in the same way.
So what exactly do you miss about Chicago? Like, what is the ownership aspect that's just not here?
There's a shared experience in Chicago that I think, you know, regardless of if you're a D's and D's guys from the far north side or from the south, far south side, or if you're, you know, a hipster living in Logan Square or in what used to be Wicker Park or Pilsen now, you know, there feels like there's a unified experience there that everyone takes ownership over. There's, you know, there's certain experiences that people glom to, and there's certain histories that people acknowledge. And I don't know if I see those things as much here. I think it's more difficult to embrace local politics here because, you know, most of the people who were involved in those things 20 years ago are gone.
Are you still following local politics for Chicago?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you find that's weird? You don't live there, but your family lives there and you're there a lot.
Yeah.
What bothers you from the distance that you have now about Chicago politics? I know that's a very broad question, but there's got to be something going on right now where you're just like, oh, that's wrong. How does everyone not care about this?
Well, you know,
I think you're going to talk about the obvious, by the way.
Yeah, the obvious is, you know, whatever is about to happen with police brutality is the hot button issue at the moment. So you've got the possible cover up of the murder of Laquan McDonald. You've got the Ronald Johnson tape coming out earlier this week. You've got the tape of the brother who got tased to death in a jail cell. You've got, you know, all of these things, and so heads are rolling. So you just watched the IPRA chief resign. You just watched the chief of detectives resign. You just watched the chief of police resign, and I feel those things very, very intimately, not only because I was a kid who did get stopped as a kid and taken to the wrong neighborhood and left there to walk home, or I do have friends who got beat up by the cops, or I do have friends who got disappeared for a few hours. All of those things touch me very intimately. And, you know, those are things that I'd like to see changed. Additionally, I think that the city's in just really, really rough financial shape, and I just want to... I want to see like that pain spread out evenly amongst, you know, the entire city, as opposed to just starving off entire sections and hoping that people go to the new DePaul basketball stadium.
We're both alumni. We should point that out.
Yeah, go Blue Demons.
Not proud alumni. Are you proud of being from DePaul? Because I'm not. I'm not proud. I used to be not proud.
Yes.
I think I'm somewhere in the middle right now. But are you glad you went there?
DePaul's a good middle class finishing school. It's it will prepare you for a lot of experiences. I don't know. I don't like. It's not something that I'd lead with, just because I don't think anyone would care. But it's not something that I'm not proud of. It was we had excellent facilities. I had great instructors. It was an okay price.
Which is crazy to think about what it costs. And like, that's an okay price. That's absurd. That's not an okay price, but comparatively, it totally is. That's messed up.
Yeah. It was a good school. Like, I can't say, like, terrible things about it. You know, they have a strong inkling towards social justice. Vincentian service is something that's...
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not going to knock any of that.
Yeah, it's
now I just feel like a bad person for saying I'm not proud of it.
No.
Maybe I'm just not proud of paying that student loan bill every month.
Well.
You never told me about getting taken to the wrong neighborhood by cops.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. It's
how old were you?
I don't know, probably...
High school, college?
After. Yeah, high school-ish.
So, like, when you're at one of your most vulnerable times as a person?
Yeah. You mouth off to a cop, or you... in my situation, I was hanging out with some kids who I shouldn't have been hanging out with, or who were, you know, doing whatever kids do.
But why shouldn't you have been hanging out with them? Like, there's nothing inherently wrong with hanging out with other kids. Were they doing... Yeah.
They weren't doing anything terrible, but they were the kids that the cops knew were up to, you know, trouble sometimes. And, you know, a cop drives you what is probably 20 minutes out of your way, but is, you know, in real life about an hour and a half walk or a however long walk.
20 minutes in Chicago could either be like 2 miles or like 10. And if based on an hour and a half walk, I'm going to go with like 6-7 miles.
Yeah, so way out of your way, and so now you're walking back across town, and overall you're fine, but it's a situation where you can now get yourself into some real trouble because some jerk cop left you in the wrong neighborhood so that you can get trouble made for you.
And this is relatively common?
Yeah, that happened a lot. Not to me, but it's a thing that I heard about a lot.
Well, that's just horrible.
Yeah.
Have you heard about that kind of stuff in D.C. happening?
No, I just don't. Again, I don't.
Like you said, there's no like teenagers. Really, I mean, there are teenagers. They shouldn't
exist,
say that. Yeah,
but not
in the quadrant in which we live.
The DC that I live in is an adult playground. It is full of brunch and holiday pop up stores. And
speaking of adult playgrounds, you mentioned DIY spaces, and we were both big proponents of that in Chicago. And there's some sort of like house music, not house music, but house culture here with shows and stuff. But like you also said, it's an adult playground. Yeah. And those DIY spaces here just don't exist in the same way. What initially drew you to those in Chicago? And I think you could actually say their names now because they're probably all shut down.
I was very closely involved with Connect Four in my days, which eventually morphed into Multiculti. Still very good friends with John Boy and all those guys. The Buddy Space was the space that got me into things. Heart of Gold, which I think still exists. I'm not quite sure. Up in Lincoln Square, there was Camp Gay, which was one of my favorites in Wicker Park. There were just a ton of these spaces. And what was really cool about the spaces was you saw a bunch of brown, queer, survivalist, urbanist, you know, you saw a bunch of people from just a variety of different backgrounds sort of embracing each other and just being very creative all in one space. And there weren't any barriers to entry. There were no barriers to leaving. You sort of came and went as you pleased. And you could give as much as you wanted or take as much as you wanted, and it was all love. There was always a dance party. And I built this really great community back home with folk who are still, like, around and doing really amazing things. You know, Eric Labrad, who runs Glitter Guts, is a good friend of mine who, you know, is documenting the scene now. Hollywood Holt, who got signed to Kanye, like... One of my earliest memories in the scene was him asking me to like a dance battle. And I was like, I don't dance. You know, you've got Floster Damas who came out of that scene. Like there are so many folk who came up and, you know, and we got to experience this very special moment in history all together, all for like no money or dirt cheap. We all have these really wacky adventures. And, in the very dangerous world that now as a 30-year-old, I'm like, oh man, all of that was really crazy. Like we sort of protected each other.
Sure. Do you romanticize that because it was that time in your life or was it actually that good?
It was a pretty amazing time. You know, you could really write a book about those times. So, I, I think that I do gloss over some of the worst parts, which are having to walk back across town because no cab would take me to Austin, or the 77s ruining everybody's good times, or just being a really anxious, like, 19, 20, 21-year-old. But on the whole, that was a really special time in my life.
But do you want to go back to that?
That wouldn't be the Chicago that I go back to.
What is the Chicago you go back to? Because I kind of feel like out of all of my friends, you're the one who's going to go back next.
So that's a good question. I think that I would have to rebuild my life somewhat in going back to Chicago. I think that partially growing a little bit older and partially just the changes in everyone else's lives, I wouldn't be going back to the same place that I left when I was 26. When I was 26, I was living in the West Loop with my then girlfriend, and you know, my life was something. And now when I'd be going back, I'd be in a completely different situation. And so the life I'd be going back to would be a very different space.
Do you think leaving made you less cynical?
I would say this. I think that I certainly undervalued the work that was happening in cities and states before I came to D.C. When I came to D.C., I saw how distant the work that people were doing here was from the work that was happening on the ground. And as well, I saw just some comical things or some comical inefficiencies here where people are spending, you know, five times the budget of what you'll have in Chicago or in Tulsa or in other places. And doing a quarter of the work, and I'm a little bit stunned by it sometimes.
Could you take any of that and use that lesson that you've learned, or is it just such? It's just a big observation.
It's a big observation. I think that I don't think that I've become less cynical. I do think that I've just grown more appreciative of, like, just doing the right thing. When I came here, it felt like the comparison I always make is that politics and acting are very similar. Like, I felt like I was sort of hitting the big time by going to D.C. and going to D.C. like to work for the country's largest union, to work for, you know, for a great wage, to do this really high profile job. And then you go, oh, man, I just don't feel very connected to the reasons. I feel less connected to the reasons I got into this work in the first place. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to get sucked into, you know, a conference schedule, or it's very easy to get sucked into a round of brunches, or into, like, these side things, or to any number of things, and to get very, very far away from actually doing work. And the thing that I've grown to appreciate about Chicagoans and home is, like, how much work I'd actually got to do.
You have a girlfriend.
Do.
You brought her to Chicago. Where did you take her?
Oh, let's see. I took Liz to Lao Se Suan in Chinatown. We had hot pot, and it was amazing. We went to the Chicago home of chicken and waffles. I also think I took her to Lou Malnati's. I wanted to take her to a...
Because you had to, legally.
Yeah, well... yeah, I wanted to take her to a neighborhood pizza place, but we were staying in Brownsville, and so it's just really difficult to get, like, to where I wanted to go to get pizza. But she really enjoyed that pizza. We biked along the lake. We went to the cultural center briefly. Yeah, we had a ball.
What did she think?
She was there to speak for a conference. And she likes Chicago. She's very worried about the cold. My goal this winter was to drag her out there at some point. I think I'm still working on it.
Still working on it? The cheapest flights are coming up, man.
Yeah, we're talking about it. So her anniversary gift to me was an agreement to move to Chicago if that's going to happen. And so there's just less pressure to bring her out. Now I'm just like, you're stuck.
It's so great. Yeah. Are you going to move back to Austin? Are you going to go back to the West Loop? What are you thinking?
So all things equal, the place that I would want to move if that happens is either historic Austin or the near West Side.
Those are somewhat different neighborhoods.
Not especially, no. So if you look at historic Austin, or Austin Village, as they call it in some places, if you cross Austin, now you're in Oak Park. Mm-hmm. And so it's this little nook that is filled with these impossibly gorgeous houses. They're Victorian style. They're massive, well-lit, all these things. And then you've got, if you go a little bit further east, you're in the hood, which is some good, some bad. And then it's whatever. If you move into the near west side or into East Garfield Park, it's the same situation, where if you go slightly slightly east, you're in the West Loop, where it's, you know, all sunshine and candy. That's an overstatement, obviously. And if you go slightly to the west, you're in West Garfield Park, which is still a little bit rough.
Okay.
Yeah.
But why? What's drawing you to those neighborhoods?
They're neighborhoods that have a strong history behind them. The housing prices are pretty good. They've got great infrastructure, so they've got wide streets. They're close to public transit. They've got, you know, families and gardens, and they're a community.
Yeah. You just really bummed me out, because I was like, I want to see how much these houses cost. So I just searched Redfin for Austin, specifically the historic Austin.
Yeah.
I could afford a 3-bedroom house for 2/3 of what I'm paying now for rent.
I know. That was the selling point for Liz.
1-bedroom to 3-bedroom, 2/3 of the price. Jesus. Sorry.
I told Liz if... She's finishing her PhD, and she's got 2 years of writing to do. I said, look, for what I'm paying in D.C. for rent, I could move home and pay probably 2/3 of that and still come away with a pretty nice apartment or house. So if you come with me, I'll cover rent for the next couple of years while you figure things out.
You're a catch.
Thanks.
You're obviously going to go back for Christmas.
Yeah.
You're obviously going to see your family.
Yeah.
When they talk to you about here, what do they think? Do they beg you to come back? Do they want you to stay?
No, my parents are like, I don't know how to say this, but I think that my mom sees a lot of, my mom's very proud of me. I'm a mama's baby, and I'm everything that she hoped would happen. And so she just wants to see me be happy, and regardless of whatever it is I do. So my grandma doesn't know what I do. She thinks I'm an FBI agent for some reason.
What do you tell her?
No, so I think that there's what I tell her and what I think she hears. And so when she talks to my mom, I presume all she hears is that I was in Africa, and then I was in Guatemala, and then I was in San Francisco, and then I was in this other place, and then I was and I travel a lot, and so I don't talk with her nearly as much as I should, and I don't really like clue her in on what's actually happening, because also, like, context wise, it's very difficult sometimes to explain like what I'm doing in a place. Mm-hmm. So in one place I went and I was talking about post election reconciliation, which is, you know, what happens after you lose an election and how do you start building for the next election immediately? And, you know, I was in Big Sur talking about the ethics of digital organizing and how do we like live our whole selves while still trying to save the world. Like, these are things that are very, like, very abstract to talk about with my 70 plus year old grandma. Like, I think she's 77 at this point. So, like, it's very difficult to then go to her and say, well, we're just talking about, like, feelings. And so I think all she hears is that I'm doing these really awesome things and that she's really proud of me. And so, like, my family are all just they're all just really happy that I'm doing things that are making me happy. And, you know, they're behind me regardless of what I do.
It's so nice.
Yeah.
It's so nice to hear. That's probably a good reason to want to go back as well, to be around them.
Yeah. My younger brother is 14 now, and I want to, like, be a better big brother to him because I, you know, as with everybody, I don't talk with people as much as I should. And I want to be supportive of him as he starts his own journey and he figures out what he wants to do and how he wants to do those things. You know, I'd love if potentially I'm going to have a family, if that might potentially happen, I'd like to be closer to my family as well. I think my family doesn't really care what I do. They just, you know, my mom just really is over the moon here that I'm living like a very full life. My parents are very excited to hear I'm living a really full life and that.
That's so great. Does your job know you're looking for Chicago right now?
Not exactly. No. So that is one of the good things about, living in DC is that nobody expects you, like, no one would be mad to know that you're looking for another job or that you're looking to move in some way or you're looking to get more out of your job or ask for a promotion or anything like that. If you're not pushing for those things, you're not working really hard here. So at the moment, the goal would be either to take my job with me for a short amount of time or to figure it out.
Good luck.
We'll see what happens.
Is there anything else that I think that I might have forgotten that you would like to talk about?
Oh, boy. I don't know. I just think DC is such a strange, strange place. I don't know if I'd be having this sort of conversation if I'd moved to, say, Philly.
Yeah.
Or even if I'd moved to, say, New York, like where I think New York is very similar. I think San Francisco is very similar. But DC is very just bizarre because it's such a company town. And it's also a town that is sort of going through a just breakneck transformation. And so it's very strange to be here. I'm grateful for the time that I've spent here so far. I've learned a lot. I've made some pretty good friends. It's not as bad as I constantly say, but it's certainly it's certainly a place that I think I'll be very happy when I'm not here.
That's good to end with.
I'd like to thank Harold for taking the time to talk with me on an early December evening. If you would like to follow us on social media, we're at UbiEstMiaPod on Twitter. Friend us on Facebook. It's UbiEstMia. Our theme songs are both by Daniel Knox. He's a fantastic musician out of Chicago. Go look him up, Daniel Knox. Our logo is by amazing artist Dmitry Samarov, also from Chicago. Please follow him. If you'd like to follow me, Brandon Weatherby, on social media, I'm on Twitter, @YMTE. And the other show they do is called You, Me, Them, Everybody. Go to youmethemeverybody.com for more information about that. Thanks for listening, and have a wonderful night.